What was it like before women had the right to choose?
Before Roe v. Wade, and when there was no legal abortion, women had to put their lives on the line. There is no doubt that many women were butchered and died without the ability to have this medical procedure in a safe, sterile environment.
That's abortion rights pioneer Merle Hoffman. We talked to her about her book, Intimate Wars. And how come we have the most expensive, least effective healthcare system in the industrialized world?
What has happened is that we allowed Wall Street analysts and investors to take over our healthcare system when we weren't paying attention. And to be able to satisfy the profit obsession of investors, insurance companies in particular, have to do things that actually result in so many of us not having access to care, or people being denied coverage when they do have insurance.
That's Wendell Potter. He'll tell us about his book, Deadly Spin, in the second half of the show. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. 39 years ago this week, American women won the right to choose. That's when Roe v. Wade was decided on a 7-2 majority vote in the Supreme Court. My guest, Merle Hoffman, was one of the pioneers of abortion services for women. In 1971, 2 years before Roe v. Wade, she founded Choices Women's Medical Center in Queens, shortly after New York State legalized abortion. But after 4 decades in women's health, Merle Hoffman is afraid that American women may be headed back to the dark days before legalization, when women died in droves from illegal back-alley abortions. Over 90% of U.S. counties now have no abortion providers, and state after state in Republican hands has passed laws restricting access to abortion services. Even previously pro-choice Republicans, like Mitt Romney, are spouting their anti-abortion tirades on the hustings, while theocrats like Rick Santorum and libertarians like Ron Paul can't wait to take away a woman's right to choose. Merle Hoffman chronicles the story of the fight for that right in her book, Intimate Wars. I started out our interview by asking Hoffman how her clinic got started.
I started with Choices. I actually founded it 2 years prior to the Supreme Court decision legalizing abortion in 1973 in Roe v. Wade. And there were, since 1970, approximately 4 or 5 states that decriminalized their abortion laws. And New York was one of them. And at the time, I was going to school, getting my doctorate, and working 3 jobs. And one of them was with a physician who was involved in HRP, and actually, when the law came down in New York, was interested in starting the service. And because I was working there and working with him, I found it very romantic, interesting, psychologically challenging. I was totally apolitical. So I started this small service, seeing patients, in 1971. And then I basically fell in love with the work. And how that happened was through the patients. And I will never forget the first patient I saw was a woman from New Jersey. And she came to us because abortion was still illegal in New Jersey. And I spoke to her. I stayed with her throughout her abortion, and I held her hand. And it was that intimate personal connection that was my catalyst. So throughout the last 4 decades, I have been instrumental, basically, in creating the operational world of legal abortion, which means the service end of legal abortion, as well as being tremendously involved in the political aspect and how abortion is defined and talked about and dealt with in terms of psychology, philosophy, and politics. So now, from that first patient, Choices is the largest women's medical center in the country. We see over 35 to 40,000 patients a year for family planning, abortion, gynecology, prenatal care, and sterilization, counseling, and all sorts of well-woman services.
You know, I do remember, I was quite a young woman in college when Roe v. Wade happened, and I remember the incredible feeling of relief that I had when that decision came down from the Supreme Court. For the many younger women who are listening to this broadcast, could you describe what it was like before Roe v. Wade?
Well, yes, before Roe v. Wade, and when there was no legal abortion, women had to put their lives on the line. If they had the access or knew somebody or had a referral or had the money, they might go to some, you know, back alley and have an illegal abortion, which had tremendous problems. I mean, there were all sorts of infections that happened with this and many, many deaths. It's hard to determine how many women died, but, you know, because this was so clandestine, but there is no doubt that many women were butchered and died without the ability to have this medical procedure in a safe, sterile environment. Now, the first time I ever heard the word abortion, I was about 10 years old in Philadelphia, and I heard my parents discussing a very notorious case. This case had to do with a doctor in Philadelphia who was doing illegal abortions, and a woman died on his table, and he cut her up and put her down the drain. Now, I'm not saying that this happened to everyone. There were some what was called doctors of conscience who were doctors who were, in fact, able to do somewhat safer procedures, and some women, many women did survive, but a lot of them didn't. So, you know, for a lot of women, young women growing up now, there's this extraordinary sense of entitlement, and then they just can't imagine what it was like. In fact, they used to call the emergency rooms at Bellevue Hospital in New York the Midnight Express. What would happen is women would try to self-abort, that they would insert something into their uterus, very often wire hangers, and go to their doctors. They would be bleeding, and the doctor would take them into the hospital and say they were just doing a D&C, which in fact was an abortion. So this is a very, very critical women's health service that should be naturally integrated into all of women's medicine. But unfortunately, it's become so politicized that women still have to risk their lives to have them.
And more women are risking their lives as abortion services become less and less available to...
Right, yeah. Less and less available, right? And over 90% of counties in this country have no abortion providers. There have been 61 legislative attempts and some passage of bills this past year from the anti-choice legislators, and mainly Republicans, who have attempted to put every kind of obstacle imaginable in the way of women and girls exercising their reproductive choice. I mean, really, if they don't succeed in making abortion illegal by overturning Roe v. Wade, they will make abortion impossible, and they have almost been able to do that for many, many, many women.
Yeah, we did have one victory this year that was in Mississippi with the defeat of the personhood bill. Could you talk, what did you feel about that?
You know, I've been in this war for four decades, and there are many, many battles. And that was one battle. And it's good that, you know, the electorate woke up and said, hey, you know, it might be a problem if they make a sperm and an egg a person at the moment of conception. It might affect, you know, in vitro fertilization. It might affect birth control. I mean, it's good that they woke up to that possibility. But rest assured that, you know, all of these human life amendments are not finished. There is a very strong feeling among many, many pro-life people that the minute a sperm and an egg come together, you have a human being, and that human being is entitled to every sort of citizen, you know, respect and legal protection. So I say, that's great. Let them pay taxes. Let the fetuses, you know, be signed up for the military. You know, I mean, what are rights without responsibilities? You know, I mean, look, in 1976, Henry Hyde passed the Hyde Amendment, and this was to cut off Medicaid for all poor minority and young women. Okay, that's who gets Medicaid. And that's what was, that's what absolutely politicized me. You know, I just couldn't believe that this man, he sat up there, and I'll never forget what he said. He said, well, if we can't save all the babies, we can at least save the babies of the poor. So that means he cuts off any kind of safety net and Medicaid payment for any poor woman who needs to have an abortion. So these are the ones that don't have access, that try to self-abort, that may have abortions in a later gestation. I mean, the whole thing is surreal, really.
And what do you think is really behind this politics of abortion? I mean, this way of criminalizing women.
I've always believed that abortion is a power decision, power and survival. I mean, in the abortion decision, women have the power of life and death. They decide whether the fetus that's growing within them is going to come to term. And I'm not one of those people that say it's not alive, it's only blood and tissue. Obviously, if you don't have an abortion in 9 months, most likely you will deliver a child, okay? So this is the only area where women have the power to determine life and death. Every other area of our lives in society, in terms of the military, in terms of criminal justice, it's men, it's the power structure who decides that. So this power is something that is the struggle. And I've always seen it this way. I believe that the religious aspect is a cloak, basically, for this basic power struggle, and I don't see this ending in my lifetime at all.
Wow. You're listening to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with pro-choice advocate Merle Hoffman about her book, Intimate Wars, The Life and Times of the Woman Who Brought Abortion from the Back Alley to the Boardroom. You know, it is ironic because the very same people, many of the very same people who are anti-abortion are pro-military and pro-death penalty.
Well, don't expect to see, you know, any consistency. But anyway, you know, foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. Foolish consistency. Yeah, I mean, they are anti-abortion, pro-military, pro-death penalty because you are killing guilty people. In war, you're killing the enemy. In capital punishment, you're killing a sinner. In abortion, you're killing this innocent life. And there's this concept of innocence that they pull up, you know. It's this innocence without sin. So that's why they can be very comfortable with saying, of course, you know, guillotine the murderer, but don't you dare, you know, let a four-week fetus be aborted.
Mm-hmm.
Sexuality is this enormous power that they see given by God, you know, for his value. And if one doesn't use sexuality in its rightful place, which is marriage between heterosexuals, then it's all sin and dirty and messy, and you just have to listen to Santorum, you know? I mean, no sex outside of heterosexual marriage, and overturn any of the marriages between same-sex couples. I mean, it's the sex that they have a problem with, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it's interesting hearing you talk, because it's clear that you have a deep understanding of the other side. And there was, in fact, a time when people who were pro-choice and people who were anti-abortion were able to talk to each other. I mean, things were not quite as polarized as they are today. Could you talk a little bit about that and how it shifted?
Well, I actually don't agree with you. I think that it's been more and more solidified as time goes on. You know, in the beginning, in the early 70s, there wasn't very much anti-abortion activity. By 1979, there was the first act of violence when Bill Baird's clinic in Hempstead, Long Island, was firebombed. And after that, it started to escalate. And in the beginning, in the early days, you know, when we had just won this major victory, and you talk about how you felt, how much relief you felt, there was just no conception that anything could be done to change what was happening. Abortion was legal, and, you know, that's it. We're going to put our feet up. We've won this great war. But that's really not what happened. You know, the Right to Life organization started to get stronger and stronger and stronger. And by the, you know, late 70s, mid-80s, I mean, it really solidified into pro-life and pro-choice. And then you had more of the violence, more the Operation Rescue people came in. You know, friends and colleagues of mine have been murdered. So there hasn't been this kind of talking. I mean, I debated almost every Right to Life leader, including Jerry Falwell. But most people, you know, most of the pro-choice people would diminish or demean the Right to Life as, oh, they're crazy. They're so crazy. They'll never be able to do anything. But they're crazy like foxes because they didn't stop. So after all this time, 40 years later, we are back 61 anti-choice legislative attempts in the past year. 61, you know. So, and these Republican candidates can't get in front of each other fast enough to say who's more anti-life. I think Rick Perry came out recently and he said, oh, even in the case of incest, yeah, I am anti-abortion. So has there been an attempt to talk to the other side? Yes, there was a movement called Common Ground. That was an attempt by some thought leaders in the anti-choice movement and some in the pro-choice movement that there were areas of connection, areas of, you know, that both sides could agree on and work on together. Like, if you really don't want abortion, you know, then let's try and stop unwanted pregnancies. But you run into the problem is that they really have problem with most birth control because they have a problem with sex, all right, outside of that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it went in and out. And I have to tell you, I think it was in 82, I had a debate with Nellie Gray, who was the woman who organizes the Right to Life marches every January in Washington. You know, these big major events that they have. And we were debating. It was I think it was on a television show, and I made this point. I said, listen, you know, why can't we agree on, you know, making sure that women use birth control, that they know what they're doing so they don't have unwanted pregnancies? And she looked at me and she said, you know, when you put the knives down and stop killing, that's when we'll have our discussion.
Oh, my God.
I don't see anything changing since then, really.
Now, the violence that started, as you noted, in a clinic on Long Island, probably not all that far from where your clinic is, Hempstead.
No, very close. And Bill Baird is a very good friend of mine, and he's actually going to introduce me at my first book reading next week. The violence, yes, it started there in 79, and by the 80s it was very, very intense, you know. I mean, I had bomb threats, death threats. George Tiller was a friend of mine. Gunn, I knew. Slepian, I knew. And these are doctors that were gunned down by these people.
Well, what is it like now? I mean, do you feel the threat? Do the people who work at your clinic feel the threat? What is it like to work in this kind of atmosphere?
Well, you know, for me, I don't know what it's not like anymore. In a strange way, I mean, I think that I've accommodated to this life of intensity and stress and struggle and battle. And a lot of the people who work with me have done also. We haven't had specific threats recently, but when I did move into this building, there were threats to bulldoze the space, and there was a point when Janet Reno had to send armed guards to protect me. And the staff was very good because they're committed, you know? You know, if you think about this, I'm giving not only a legal service, but a very needed service. Women are coming to me for all sorts of women's health and gynecological issues and to have their babies. And we have to operate in a war zone. And that's not only me. That's all of the providers. All of the providers around the country.
And do you have people outside your clinic, you know, kind of, you know, holding up the signs and trying to dissuade women from going in?
I have 2 to 3 very consistent protesters, and I have one called Sister Dorothy, who is a nun, and she's actually in my book. And she and I have had multiple discussions, and she's out there in rain or shine. You know, they're very indefatigable, the antis. I mean, I on some level, I respect them because they absolutely fight for their beliefs, and they're out there every single day doing what has to be done. I respect them, but I'll do everything in my power to defeat them.
Now, it hasn't just been violence that's been used to suppress and discourage clinics from providing these services to women. You had an investigation of Medicare fraud that came down
right,
on you.
Right.
Talk
right.
a little bit about that.
Yes. One of the ways of harassment and political attack to abortion facilities is through the governmental agencies. And at one point in time, I was being investigated for Medicaid fraud, which was absolutely untrue. I was just trying to give non-discriminatory service to patients, Medicaid patients, who were not covered for anesthesia. So it's a long story, and ultimately, it went away. I was not indicted, but I spent 7 years struggling and fighting this indictment. It's been a very wild ride, because the attacks can come anywhere. They can come from the government. They can come from the press. They can come from what I call paid enemies, which are employees who come in and work here and who actually try to sabotage the organization.
Mm. We're speaking with Merle Hoffman about her book, Intimate Wars, The Life and Times of the Woman Who Brought Abortion from the Back Alley to the Boardroom. So let's talk about this boardroom idea. This is a for-profit clinic, is that correct?
Yes.
And so you've come under some criticism. I mean, it's ironic that, business is king in this country, but if you make money at providing abortion services to women, you come under criticism for making a
Absolutely.
Profit.
Absolutely. Yeah, isn't that interesting? And that's also part of the criticism of feminists, because there are a lot of feminists who are very anti-capitalist, and a lot of them who are feminist socialists. And there was a feeling, a lot of the marches and demands at one point were abortion without apology, free on demand. Now, I think it's extraordinarily naive. How are you going to have free abortions? Who's going to provide them? Who's going to pay for the people to provide? It's just not realistic. I'm a visionary, but I'm also a pragmatist. I have a strong entrepreneurial spirit, and I use so many of my profits to give back to the movement, and I've never been apologetic about this. People would accuse me, abortion, is your business. You're in the business of abortion. Like, business is, it's a five-letter word. So, I would say no. I'm in the business of women's lives. Women's lives are my business. And I don't apologize for any of it.
Now, I wanted to ask you about the administration just previous to this one, because you talk about this in your book, Intimate Wars, and you actually say that both the Bush and the Clinton administrations were the most violative of the government interference and choice. I guess my question is, first of all, talk about that, tell us what happened. But also, what about your perspective? Clinton was supposed to be a liberal. So what is this about, this bipartisan?
Well, what happens, let me tell you what happens when you get a pro-choice president. You have, under Clinton, I think we had the highest statistical rate of violence and murders of abortion providers. And why that is that the movement, the anti-abortion movement, becomes more disenfranchised from the power structures. And it creates more rage and more disenfranchisement. And it results in a lot more guerrilla tactics and violence and street harassment. During Bush's administration, there was quite a lot less, because Bush was pro-life, so these people could hear it from the pulpit, and they felt more validated. But there were other things going on during the Clinton administration that were problematic in terms of specific regulations, very complicated HIPAA requirements. The important thing to understand is that the person in the White House, depending on the pro or anti-choice, is going to have an effect on the people on the outskirts of the movement, or the radical part of it.
Yeah, okay. So looking at it now today, as we mentioned earlier, there was the failure of one extremely draconian anti-choice bill in Mississippi that got defeated. What do you feel is important for us to do, for women to do, for the supporters of women's choice to do, in this age where there just seems to be so much behind the anti-choice movement?
I think the first thing is we have to accept the fact that there's a constituency in this country of women who have had abortions, who have had experience with friends or family that have had abortions, that would make probably 200 million people. You know, I mean, there's a massive constituency. One out of three women in this country have abortions at one point in time in their lifetime. In a sense, abortion is American as apple pie. So what I would say is that we have to first accept that reality and own it, talk about it. If you had an abortion, say it. You know, there are so many women who come to Choices and come to the clinics, and by that act in itself, they're making a political statement. Yet when they leave, they want to forget about it and leave it all behind. There's always the feeling that the pro-choice forces march under a grayer banner than the anti-choice forces. It's not as white, it's not as pure, but it's more true. That may be true, but ours is the truth, because ours is the truth of women's lives. I mean, if you think about it, all of these things keep passing and they put them up more and more radical anti-choice legislative attempts, and it's like there's no line in the sand. There's a feeling that one can do almost anything and it will pass, because there's not enough activism, there's not enough collective rage, there's not enough putting these politicians' feet to the fire, and the realization that, you know, you can't make these compromises because you're going to sell out women who are your constituency, but that's not there yet. It's just not there yet. You know, in a strange way, I think what may happen is that more and more of these anti-choice attempts will be successful, and it will start to hit, you know, middle-class people, young women, and maybe that will radicalize them. It hasn't happened to this point. Mm-hmm. I'm not terribly optimistic.
And yet we do have examples of women like you, and I'm so glad that you were there. Your book is Intimate Wars, The Life and Times of the Woman Who Brought Abortion from the Back Alley to the Boardroom. Merle Hoffman, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
In addition to her work at the helm of Choices Women's Medical Center, Merle Hoffman publishes and edits On the Issues magazine. Next up, we talk with Wendell Potter about his expose of the health insurance industry. It's called Deadly Spin. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. 52 million Americans have no health insurance at all, and millions more are woefully underinsured. It's a deadly situation. More than 45,000 people die every year in the U.S. because they lack health insurance. It's what you get when the health insurance industry puts profits before people. My guest, Wendell Potter, knows about that better than most. He was once vice president of corporate communications at Cigna, one of the nation's biggest health insurance companies. But in June 2009, Potter testified against the industry in the U.S. Senate as a whistleblower. The fascinating story of how he went from corporate spin doctor to whistleblower is chronicled in Potter's book, Deadly Spin. I spoke with him about it in November 2011. Wendell Potter, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much, Francesca.
In Deadly Spin, you've got a pretty shocking figure right at the beginning of the book. You say about 45,000 people die in America every year, that's 123 people a day, because they have no health insurance. And you follow up that sentence by saying, quote, "I am partly responsible for some of the deaths making up that shameful statistic." How are you responsible?
Because for a good part of my career, I was part of an effort to mislead the public about just how dysfunctional our healthcare system has become and how the practices of the health insurance industry that I worked in for 20 years has made it necessary for so many of our fellow Americans to go without coverage. 50 million of us and counting don't have adequate or don't have any insurance, and many millions of others of us don't have adequate health insurance. And that study, or that figure is from a study done by Harvard researchers a few years ago that noted that 45,000 people die every year because they don't have access to care because they're uninsured in this country. And that, regrettably, happens in no other country but the United States.
And one of those people was a girl named Nataline Sarkisian. Her case caused a pretty profound change in you. It was a pretty life-shaping experience. Tell us about Nataline Sarkisian, and what role did you play in that? How did that affect you?
Well, as it turns out, Nataline Sarkisian and her family had insurance, and they had coverage through Cigna, so they actually were not, or she was not, among the 45,000. She was among many other Americans who die every year because their insurance companies say, no, you're not going to get coverage for a treatment that your doctor says you need. She was 17 years old. She had had leukemia previously. It was in remission, but it came back, and the treatments that the doctors were trying were not working, so they said that she would need a bone marrow transplant, which she did have, and then a liver transplant. And her doctors felt that she would have a good chance, better than even chance, of living for at least 5 years if she had the transplant. But a medical director more than 2,500 miles away, who had never examined her, said no, he didn't agree with those doctors. He felt that in her case it would be experimental. So the company refused to pay for the transplant. The family was just astonished. They knew they had coverage. They knew the coverage included transplants. So it never occurred to them that they would have a problem with their insurance company saying no. But that's exactly what happened, and the family was able to raise attract a lot of public attention to this case, to the point that Cigna finally agreed to cover it. But so much time had passed between when the original request was made and when Cigna said it would cover the transplant that she got sicker and her other organs began to shut down, and regrettably, just 5 days before Christmas in 2007, Nataline died. And I was the person who was the main spokesperson for the company, and I just didn't have it in me anymore to be a spokesman for an industry that really, frankly, operates death panels in this country. We heard during the debate on health care reform that the legislation that was ultimately enacted created death panels in the government. It was never true. What is true is that death panels exist in this country, and they exist within the private health insurance companies that we have.
Yeah, and so if Nataline with insurance died, you can just imagine what happens. I mean, what are the mechanisms? How does it happen that so many people die without it? Is it just that, they're not getting the acute care they need, or is it more that they're not getting the care that might have been able to cure them at an earlier stage?
It's all of that. It's both of that. And they don't get the preventive care, the early care that they should have that might keep them from getting chronically ill. So they don't get that. And, they're left in many cases to go into the emergency room when they get really sick. And that's not obviously the most appropriate place to get care, and it's expensive, and they don't have the means to pay for it. So many people don't even go to the emergency room because of that. And because they don't have adequate coverage, they don't take the medications they should have, they don't go to the doctor as regularly as they should, so their lives are shortened considerably.
I was down at Occupy Wall Street. There were an awful lot of people who held signs talking about the fact that they have to make a choice between medications and food. I talked to nurses who were there who were saying that they're seeing in their patients that they have to make choices between medication and food, that they can't afford the care. What are some of your thoughts as you see this movement and the whole issue that you've been writing so passionately about?
Well, And I'm glad you mentioned that, because few people really understand that we've had a Wall Street takeover of our healthcare system. And the signs that you saw and the people you talked to are just among the many victims of our of what really is a sickness industry. I don't even refer to it as a healthcare system, because you know we have a transportation system in this country. We have an educational system, and it's a system that is equally accessible by every American. But you can't say the same thing about our healthcare system, and I put that word in quotes. And what has happened is that we allowed Wall Street analysts and financial analysts and investors to take over our healthcare system when we weren't paying attention, and to be able to satisfy the profit obsession of investors. Insurance companies in particular have to do things that are very anti-consumer, that actually result in so many of us not having access to care or people being denied coverage when they do have insurance.
You testified before Congress during the health reform debate. I'd like to get to asking you about some of the things that you said to them. But before that, you know, the insurance industry itself was quite involved in the crafting of that legislation. I think, in fact, you call it the Health Insurance Industry Profit Protection and Enhancement Act. Why do you call it that?
You know, I testified before Congress that if they passed the reform law without having a public option, if you remember, that was a big part of the debate, and ultimately Congress did not include the public option in the final bill. If they had, we would have had the opportunity, many of us, to get coverage from a program that might have been set up similar to Medicare, that would have been operated by the federal government. But no, the insurance industry was so powerful, so influential, they wanted to make sure that there was no public option in the bill, and they were successful. They have an extraordinarily effective and well-resourced lobbying machine in Washington and the state capitals, and it is so pervasive that they are able to influence Republicans and Democrats. They played a big role in the crafting of certain provisions of the legislation. They made it clear from the beginning what they would find acceptable and what they wouldn't. And so that's why they were able to shape the final bill in ways that I think was just really wrong and certainly not in the best interest of consumers. The one thing that they did want and that they did get was the requirement that all of us will have to buy coverage. It's the individual mandate, and I'm not adamantly opposed to that so long as we had the option of a public option, but we no longer have that. So they got two of their main objectives out of reform. They got the individual mandate included in the bill, and they made certain that the public option was not.
And what is that going to mean then once that is put into effect? I mean, I'm talking to you here from Massachusetts where, you know, I think we have that system. We have a universal mandate. I'm covered under Commonwealth Care, which is that, you know, the state subsidy, although it's paid to private insurance companies. And I have to tell you, it's been such a great load of anxiety off my shoulders. It's been wonderful. It's not perfect, but compared to what we had before, it's heaven.
And that's why I ultimately said that even without the public option, it was the right thing to do for Congress to pass this legislation, because it will bring millions of Americans into coverage who otherwise wouldn't be. I'm not at all happy that the subsidies will be going from the government straight to the private insurance companies. That certainly doesn't make me happy. But you have to balance that with the good that it does, which is bringing more people into coverage. And you also have to realize that we live in a political world, and often there are things you have to agree to do to get legislation passed you'd rather not have to do. But that's just the way things are done. It's the way the world is. And you're right, in Massachusetts, a lot of people don't have that worry that they once had, and they do have access to health insurance and consequently to good care that they didn't have before. So that's why I ultimately said Congress should pass the bill even without the public option.
And yet a lot of people outside of Massachusetts complain about what they hear is that it's very, very costly, that it's too costly. What are your thoughts on the cost of this kind of health insurance system?
Well, my thought on that is that our system, again, in quotation marks, is not ultimately sustainable, even with the Affordable Care Act. We've got a lot more to do. I call the Affordable Care Act that was passed by Congress the end of the beginning of reform. It will bring people into coverage, like we've been saying, who have not had coverage before or who have lost their coverage, which is a very, very good and important thing. We need to see this as the foundation for reform going into the future, because that's there's so much more that needs to be done. I think conceivably we may ultimately have a system that is as equitable as the systems in other developed countries and that can truly control health care cost. I'm not so certain that we can see a lot of cost savings from the Affordable Care Act. It will save some, though. I mean, when you bring more people into coverage, that alone can help bring down the cost of care. What it does is end some of the cost shifting that goes on, and it makes sure that people can get the care that they need when they need it in the most appropriate setting and the most appropriate time. And that is the most efficient and cost-effective care.
We're talking with former health insurance industry executive turned whistleblower Wendell Potter about his book, Deadly Spin. An insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. You know, I'd like to also ask you about insurance rates. I mean, we've been reading in the papers recently about huge jumps in the cost of health insurance. The insurance companies have been really jacking up the premium prices. And you talk about this in the book, too. You say that the average cost of a family health insurance policy rose to over $13,000 in 2009. I mean, we're talking about a country where, you know, I think the median wage is well under $50,000. That's an enormous chunk out of a family's income.
It is, and it keeps going up. And those increases have nothing to do with the Affordable Care Act, or very, very little. These insurance companies demanded those increases because they can. They know that there are no other options. There is no public option. Employers and individuals have no other place to go. So competition does not work in healthcare as it might in other sectors of the economy. And that number you cited was 2009. Since then, we've had 2 years have passed, and now we have average premiums for a family of four at more than $15,000 a year. And that's why I'm saying it's not sustainable. You cannot keep raising the rates or jacking up the rates indefinitely. And you can't keep shifting more of the cost of care to individuals and families and expect the system to continue to go on. It can't. It will collapse. And in fact, the Kaiser Family Foundation, which does these studies, projected that I think in 10 years from now, without meaningful change, the premium will more than double. It'll be over $30,000 for a family of four. In 5 years, it'll be well over $20,000.
And this is a time when wages are stagnating or actually going down. So
they are, and the reason they're going down, one of the main reasons, is because all of the salary increases we might have gotten have been wiped out by health care. Our employers are not giving us the raises that we otherwise would get because they are being hit by insurance companies with rate increases year after year. So to be able to continue to offer coverage and to subsidize coverage for their employees, they're having to take money that would have gone to raises and give them to the insurance companies. And a lot of that money goes straight into the pockets of rich CEOs and rich investors.
Yeah, talk a little bit about the executive compensation. I mean, that's been another demand of people who are in the Occupy Together movement, you know, because no longer just Occupy Wall Street, it's all over the country.
Right.
You know, they're talking about executive compensation that is way outsized to the average worker's wage, or even in other countries. What about the executive compensation of the guys that you worked for?
Well, it is just so completely out of hand and out of whack. The executives of insurance companies are among the most highly compensated people in the United States. They make millions and millions of dollars. In fact, if you take the most highly compensated executives of their insurance companies, they make billions of dollars. Just a few people. The highest paid CEO in the country today is the CEO of a big insurance company, United Healthcare's Stephen J. Hemsley is at the very top of Forbes magazine's list of the top paid CEOs in the country. Last year, he brought in more than $100 million. Just imagine how much coverage that would buy, how many people could be covered by $100 million, how much treatment that could pay for, but yet it's going into the pockets of one individual. And there are many other CEOs who make almost as much. The CEO that I worked for at Cigna, when he left at the end of 2009 as early retirement, he walked out the door with $111 million in his pocket.
Wow. Now, the insurance companies claim that insurance premiums are going up because the cost of doctors and medications are going up. What's your thought on that?
Well, it's true to a certain extent, and it's true because these people, these companies, have been complete failures when it comes to controlling cost and bringing more people into coverage. They said during the 1990s, when I first started working in the industry, or during the early parts of my career, that leave it to us. We can bring healthcare costs down through the techniques of managed care. We can bring more people into coverage. And so we believe them, and we let them take charge of our healthcare system. And look what's happened. They've proved to be complete failures at being able to do either. And what they do is they price premiums a certain percentage point higher than what they expect the increase in healthcare to be. So they always build in a profit margin. They don't really control cost. They just tack on an additional amount. They are truly middlemen who are making enormous amounts of money off of us. And it's not sustainable. We're going to have to eventually figure out some more rational way to provide coverage for our people.
Now, the other issue that you talk about in the book, Wendell Potter, in Deadly Spin, is underinsurance. And I remember before the Massachusetts health reform came in and I was being covered under my employer, every year it seemed that the premiums that I had to pay, the portion of the premiums that I had to pay, went up by 15-20%, but the actual coverage went down. I remember I used to joke because my plan was called Value Plus. And I used to say, well, no, I think this is Value Minus.
Yeah. These companies are brilliant at a few things. They're brilliant at making money. They're brilliant at the use of language to make us think something that isn't true. It's certainly not a value plan by any stretch of the imagination, but they want you to think that. They use terms like that because they know they poll well, they test well in focus groups. But that's also, yes, that has been something that the public has not been paying a lot of attention to. We've been fixated on the increase in premiums, and we think that is the indicator of the cost of coverage, but it's not by any means the sole indicator. In fact, it's often not the primary indicator. We're seeing that more and more of us are being shoved into plans or have no choice but to buy plans that have high deductibles and that have lower or reduced benefits. In the health insurance industry, the financial analyst and the executives call this, what's going on here, benefit buy-down. It's a euphemism that means that you're shifting more and more of the burden of care from employers and from insurance companies to individuals through a variety of means, either through reducing or eliminating certain benefits and or making people pay a lot more out of pocket for them.
Mm. And you mentioned, you know, they're very good at the spin. I mean, your book is called Deadly Spin, and it's also a lot about how the public relations industry or how public relations itself is used in a way to support these kinds of, you know, really unethical practices. It doesn't have to be, but it does. You know, if I were a consumer out there and I'm listening to the news, and I hear an insurance executive being interviewed, What are some of the common ways that the insurance industry is now spinning healthcare and health insurance? What's their program going forward?
They're focused on trying to shape how the Affordable Care Act is implemented in both Washington and in the state capitol. So that's one of their major focuses right now. They will try to make us believe that the Affordable Care Act is not in our best interest, and they're winning. They're winning the PR battle there. That's why we're seeing that support for the Affordable Care Act has continued to erode over time, or since it's been passed, or since we had the health care reform debate. People are afraid of it because of the fear-mongering from the health insurance industry and its allies. Now, the health insurers themselves and their executives, you won't see them being interviewed all that often because they know they don't have a lot of credibility. They know that they are very unpopular. So what they do is they get their talking points to people who do have, or at least perceived, greater credibility, people in the news media, people in politics, people in business who are not them. And they have this, it's a very big part of their spin operation, is to get others to carry their water for them, to deliver their talking points, and it's largely all based on fear. And the bottom line, if you will, for their fear mongering campaign is to make us think that the consumer protections in the law will cost us more money, and they're not in our best interest. What their ultimate objective is to make sure that the bill goes forward with the individual mandate intact, and that consumer protections are stripped out. That is what their objective is, and it's what we need to be on guard and not let happen.
And what are some of those consumer protections that they're trying to get stripped out?
One in particular is the requirement that they have to spend at least 80% of what we pay in premiums on health care. In 1993, insurance companies back then most insurers, most people were insured by nonprofit insurance companies. That has changed radically. It's just the opposite now. More of us are insured by for-profit companies. But since over the years, now insurance companies by and large are spending no more than 80 cents rather than 95% or 95 cents on a dollar just a few years ago. Now it's down to 80% and often much lower than that. So the law at least requires them to spend 80% of what we pay them on our health care. Investors don't like that at all. They want to have the ability to keep pressuring insurers to spend less and less and less on health care, because the less they spend on health care, the more is available to reward them in profits. So that's one of the things they don't like. They also don't like the provision that they have to cover everybody, and they don't like the provision that they have to give up the use of pre-existing conditions to refuse to sell coverage to people or to charge them exorbitant rates.
Yeah, this pre-existing conditions, it just seems incredibly bizarre. I mean, anyone who is, you know, probably over the age of 25 has been treated for something.
Oh, absolutely. We all are going to be victims of this so-called system as we age, because yes, we all get sick, or we are often born with afflictions that they consider to be pre-existing conditions, which by nature they are. And no other country does this, by the way. No other country allows insurance companies to refuse to sell coverage to people just because they need it, because they have been sick in the past, or that they were born with birth defects or some illness that is on the list of pre-existing conditions that these insurance companies keep, and it's a very, very long list. So you're exactly right. Virtually every one of us, as we age, will have or have been treated for some kind of a condition that they will consider pre-existing, enabling them to either refuse to sell us coverage or to charge us a lot more money than they otherwise would.
And the Affordable Care Act would, but it still allows them to charge more money. It says that they have to cover pre-existing conditions, but doesn't it say it? But it doesn't actually regulate the insurance premiums or changes in them. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's absolutely correct. And it's a shame that. But that's again just a tribute to the influence of the insurance industry in Washington. They were able to keep the law from having any real teeth in terms of giving regulators the power to reject rates or to keep them from discriminating against people by charging them more than they otherwise would be able to. The law allows them to charge older people at least three times as much as younger people, they wanted to charge far more than three times as much. Their objective was to be able to charge five times as much. So that's one of their lobbying goals, is to get it changed so that they can continue to gouge older people. And, you know, that's going to affect all of us if we live to be a certain age. We will all find that we're going to be victims of this industry for years to come unless we can really regulate it.
You know, there's a lot of talk about how expensive Medicare is, and with the Affordable Care Act, and in a climate where more and more Americans are falling out of the middle class and will become eligible, in fact, for subsidies, it seems to me what you're talking about here is a huge increase in the deficit, where we're basically paying the insurance, you know, it's like the bailouts of Wall Street. They don't have to pay their share. They have no costs, but the cost is going to come onto the taxpayer.
You know, you're making a very good point. Insurance companies are not being asked to give very much up at all, and they don't want to, and what they're asked to give up, they're fighting to be able to continue to keep the things that are being declared or will be declared illegal. And that's why I think, one of the reasons why I think that we may ultimately have a backlash against the Affordable Care Act. I'm being very candid here. As we see more and more of our tax dollars going straight into the treasuries of the big insurance companies, I think people are really, at some point, are going to wake up and say, this makes no sense. These companies are getting bigger, they're getting richer, and their executives are getting richer, while we're being forced by law to finance their operations. I think there's a great potential for a backlash.
Wendell Potter, you were a spin doctor for the insurance companies. Now you've exposed their practices. You've exposed that spin. What are some of the things that you think we should be doing, and how should we be framing your suggestions, your ideas, to the greater public?
You know, I think we need to pay a lot of attention to what's going on more than people are. I'm not faulting the public so much as I'm faulting our media for not covering what's going on in an effective way. They're not paying very much attention to how effective the insurance companies are to influence the regulations and the implementation of the law. But beyond that, we as patients, as consumers, as American citizens, we need to just pay attention, but we also need to be skeptical. We need to understand that we are being manipulated by friends of the insurance industry all the time. And in terms of language, what I would suggest that advocates of reform and people who are interested in this topic, they need to understand that, as I said earlier, we've had a Wall Street takeover of our healthcare system. And that's a term that I would like to see work its way into the vernacular. We heard during the debate on reform that we were on our way to a government takeover of the healthcare system. That's not true. What we have had, while we weren't paying attention, was a Wall Street takeover of our healthcare system. The law did not create death panels, but death panels do exist inside these big insurance companies. If you don't believe me, just ask the parents of Nadalene Sarkeesian.
Well, Wendell Potter, thanks so much for talking with us here about your terrific book, Deadly Spin, An Insurance Company Insider Speaks Out on How Corporate PR is Killing Healthcare and Deceiving Americans. Thanks again.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Wendell Potter is now a senior analyst at the Center for Public Integrity, a fellow at the Center for Media and Democracy, and a consumer liaison representative to the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. He also writes a column at the Huffington Post, including an Ask Wendell feature in which he responds to healthcare questions from readers. Go to writersvoice.net for a link. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at writersvoice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.